Welcome to Double Take, critical, sometimes confrontational, always amusing conversations about the movies. Double Take is a Cinema Classics production produced by John DeSando and Johnny DiLoretto. I'm Johnny DiLoretto.
I'm John DeSando.
This is Double Take.
It is.
At 91, the guy's 91. What are you going to be doing when you're 91?
I'm going to be thinking about how he lived till 100.
Yeah,
and he's my model, so I'm working at it.
You think Clint Eastwood will make it to 100?
I think he will. This guy is intrepid.
Yeah,
he's still directing films
this
and acting
like
in them.
Cry Macho is his 40th some.
Well, it's the 45th that he's directed.
That he's directed. Wow,
yeah.
Good
and
lord.
He's been in many more. His filmography, and you know, I was looking at his filmography.
Mm-hmm.
They're pretty substantial American films.
Yeah, you know, I feel like a lot of his movies, well, Clint Eastwood means a lot to me personally. And, you know, I don't care about the guy's politics.
I don't either.
I feel like, you know, if you poked around there, you might find something worthwhile or whatever. I don't care. I feel like, and, you know, thankfully we don't have to wrestle with the question of, you know, like a Roman Polanski-esque question with this guy.
Yeah.
You know?
Now, although he has been married or fathered.
Right.
By six or nine kids.
I might be part Clint Eastwood.
Oh, gee.
Wouldn't that be something? Find out your part Clint Eastwood.
He was asked in an interview how many. He said, like, a few.
So I feel like younger, I would think most people under the age of 50 or 40 even, around 40, between 40 and 50, probably only know him from the 90s on, you know, from Unforgiven onward.
Yeah.
And wow, I mean, to have lasted as long as he has, to have survived the vicissitudes of audience taste. You know, I heard someone else talking on a podcast recently about Clint Eastwood, and they said something interesting. So Clint Eastwood, and to my point, he has somehow managed to avoid a lot of things, a lot of industry changes and fads. In other words, there's maybe one movie in all of his entire filmography that has any special effects in it.
That's true.
Think about that. Clint Eastwood, the biggest special effect in Clint Eastwood movies is his face.
Look, he's a minimalist director. He hooked me in 1971.
Dirty Harry.
Just before that.
The Beguiled.
No. Play Misty for Me.
Play Misty for Me. That was his directorial debut.
Yes, and that long tracking shot along the highway in California caught me, and I was noticing again even in this recent one, Cry Macho, he loves the aerial shot that has the car going along as it did outside in Big Sur. And he just is a very romantic spirit.
Yeah.
And I thought Misty was mellow, insidious. I think it had some of the best qualities that he could have for his films, including himself as a broadcaster.
Yeah.
And one of the first directors to recognize that women are just as bad as men.
<You're right.
laughs> I mean, he got that early.
Think about what he did in 1971 with Play Misty for Me was really usher in the whole 90s era of Michael Douglas's career. I mean, Michael Douglas spent a decade making movies like Play Misty for Me.
Very good one. And then Dirty Harry's a whole other side, right?
Yeah. Of course.
And most people are going to remember him for that Dirty Harry role.
Right, which often, you know, is given short shrift. Dirty Harry is a fascinating character, especially in that first film. That first film, you know, he was accused of being fascist by Pauline Kael. You know, meanwhile, she loved whatever Sam Peckinpah was doing, and it's arguable that he had a little, you know, streak of fascism running.
Do you know they did a psychological study
on
of Pauline Kael's reviews of him?
Oh, really?
And they said she was in love with him.
What? Are you kidding?
Yes,
how
yes.
did I not know this?
Yeah, I just read this the other day.
What?
I said, well, of course.
You need to send this to me.
I know.
That's funny. It also, it is worth noting, it's the first, one of the first times, I think, in Hollywood history where a sequel to a movie, a sequel to a big hit movie, was directly influenced by the take of a critic, a film critic. So Pauline Kael leveled this accusation of fascism against Dirty Harry.
Okay.
In Magnum Force, the movie that comes right after that, Dirty Harry fights fascists, literally.
Oh, excellent, excellent. I'll tell you, one of the missteps that I still can't figure, because I really liked it, and nobody cares about it. I think they even laughed at it. He rarely does a laughable take on anything.
Okay.
But when he did Jersey Boys,
laughable.
Yeah, meaning that people were saying he couldn't do it. He couldn't do a musical, even though the man is an accomplished jazz pianist. He damn well knows music.
He made the film Bird.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Yeah. But I'm just saying.
You know what? That's one of the few Eastwood movies I haven't seen. How is
okay.
it?
And I liked it. I liked it. I understand that people would say it's not sophisticated. It's corny. You just have these guys up there singing these cover songs and not a whole lot really going on. It just seemed like boilerplate musical about a boy band.
But, I mean, it was adapted from the hit play. I mean,
I know. It just didn't. I'd have to go back to it to say why it didn't, because for me, it was just fine because I love the songs.
Yeah, you know what? I'm going to check it out. I'll let you know. But, you know, a lot of his... There's a thing Eastwood does, I've noticed. He's legendary for his one take cut and print directing style. Now I feel a lot of times I can feel him. I'm so attuned to his, you know, his iconography and his style and his directorial sort of flourishes. I can feel when he cares about a movie, when he cares about the source material in a way. So, for instance, in Unforgiven, or another great unsung movie of his, which is A Perfect World, which I think is one
which
of his.
Which is right after Unforgiven.
Yes, right, with Costner. I love that movie. You can see in the shot selection, in the way that he frames his actors, the way they move, like he's seeing it. And, you know, he may only do a take or two, but you can feel his the directorial marriage there between, you know what I mean? Like the script and the image, and he's feeling it. There are other movies I feel like he doesn't care about at all. And I remember one of them was Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil.
Oh, yes.
And it's a terrible movie.
It's a mess.
But when you see the movie, it's like he doesn't move the camera at all. He doesn't care. It's like he put the camera down and said, okay, get in front of it. Cut. He doesn't, you know what I mean? You can feel when he cares about the source material.
He is notorious. Tim Robbins said in Mystic River, that he does maybe two takes if you're lucky.
Yeah.
And he starts at 9, not any sooner than 9, and he's done after lunch.
Well, you know, that style has kept him in the good graces of the studio.
Oh, for sure. Good point.
He has finished his films on time, always under budget, and, you know, he's had this relationship with Warner Brothers for 40 years now, or more, 50 years maybe. So it just goes to show you when you stay on time and you're not fussing, you're not spending more money than you're allotted, and that movie makes a profit. That's the business, right? And somehow along the way, he's managed to make great art. You've been listening to Double Take, critical, sometimes confrontational, always conversations about movies. We're talking about, I don't even know if we can fit it all in here.
No, we can't.
The entire career of
I know.
Clint Eastwood.
Well, so I like to look at what I think to be missteps.
Yeah, please.
Here's,
I know all the missteps.
I know. I think Bridges of Madison County is a misstep.
Hold on, sorry, say that again. I just made a noise there. Go ahead.
I think Bridges of Madison County is a misstep.
You're wrong. You're wrong. That is a lovely movie.
I know it's a lovely
movie.
And that's why it really doesn't fit him that well. I find him awkward.
Yeah, you should go back and see that movie.
And of course, you're right.
Now, what's really lovely about that movie is, you know, here's a guy who, at that point in his career, you know, we're post-Unforgiven at that point, mid-90s, He is so aware of his screen presence, of what his face means, of the little things that he can do. You know, little riff. He is a jazz musician with that face, with his body, with the way his lanky, he carries his lanky frame. Opposite, you know, one of the great screen actresses of our time, Meryl Streep is an intuitive, but also a technician, you know? And to watch those two styles, you say what you will about Eastwood's limited range, he's twice the movie star Meryl Streep is. In other words, you can't just put Meryl Streep on screen and you're captivated by her. You have to give Meryl Streep a role. Do you know what I'm saying?
Oh, sure. Because she's a real actress.
She has to have a role. Oh, right. Yeah. Right. And that's the dynamism of that chemistry is really what sells that movie. Now, and also, it's just sincere and heartfelt.
Well, now where it works for me and doesn't work for others sometimes is his award-winning Million Dollar Baby in 2004, I think.
Oh, my God. That movie's one of the great movies of the
2000s. I know.
You're saying that's a misstep?
No. This for some people.
Oh.
I mean, if you ask them what their favorite is, they'll never say Million Dollar. They won't never, but I think they're reluctant to say that. For some reason that I think they will unwilling to give him the fact that he can be tough and sensitive at the same time. And I found that to be true in that movie. I found it all came together for me.
Oh, yeah,
in
that
Million
movie
Dollar
is
Baby.
Near perfection.
Yeah. What do you think then of Cry Macho?
Well, I didn't see it.
Oh,
I'm waiting to see
it. Do you think there's ever going to be a tape when you will see one of these movies?
I had to wait.
Didn't see Card Counter?
I need to wait to see this one with my kid.
I can't believe this.
Because I have effectively passed down my love of Clint Eastwood to my oldest kid.
Oh,
and we haven't seen it yet.
This is really controversial, and it would be controversial for us.
Listen, I know. Unfortunately, you're talking to someone who's seen practically every Clint Eastwood movie ever made.
I know that.
And I can speak at length about... this filmography. I'll tell you a misstep for me.
Okay.
You know, there was this post Unforgiven Clint Eastwood Renaissance. You remember that? Like, wow. You know, he won Best Director, and it was like, wow, we've really taken this guy for granted, right? And so he was just trying his hand at everything. Boom, boom, boom. One of the movies he made right after Unforgiven was Absolute Power.
Oh.
Do you remember that?
I don't even remember it.
Yes, it's absolute garbage.
Whoa.
It's one of those ones that, I'd be curious to go back and look at it, but I remember sort of feeling like, wow, this is just, you know, sometimes this style of his, this one-take wonder stuff doesn't cut it. You need to finesse a movie sometimes, and that one suffered, I think, because of that.
Well, after Million Dollar Baby, and then we had the World War II business, Flags of Our Fathers and all that stuff, which was okay for me, but nothing as exciting as I thought, Gran Torino.
Gran Torino is another great movie.
Yes, which is what I had hoped Cry Macho would have been.
Yeah. You know, there was when Gran Torino, I remember that, and I remember seeing it in the theater, and I remember the ending of that movie very specifically, and I thought to myself, this is Clint Eastwood saying goodbye. You know, he's letting us say goodbye to that hero, right, that we idolized as kids. And I thought that at the end of Unforgiven. And then I thought it again at the end of Gran Torino. And I was like, okay, we're done. Now, from everything I've read, you know, Cry Macho is another sort of goodbye.
Yeah.
And I don't know. Like, he keeps saying goodbye to us in some ways, and I'm not sure at what point that's going to lose its power.
It's delightful. It has this fabulous, unbelievable parts to it.
Okay.
The most hilarious for me is the two middle-aged chicks who come on to him.
Okay.
This has got to be a white man's fantasy.
Yeah.
Particularly a 91-year-old white man's fantasy. It is cute, though.
Listen, I mean, you just turned 80-something.
Yeah,
right?
I know.
And you have these young women half your age, doting on you.
I don't know.
Listen, it's about prowess.
It's about
having that that sexual sort of charge that you carry. They find it irresistible. I believe it.
Yeah, I want to believe it. I just can't believe it. But anyway, here, he does a sweet job with this. he actually makes it work for me. Even his relationship with this kid, which is corny beyond belief. Mm-hmm. You know, he's shepherding this kid away from Mexico. Yeah. Even that, when he says, you're growing on me, kid.
Yeah.
When I haven't seen a darn thing that would certify that the kid was growing on him. I mean, this is his minimalism gone awry.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, there's a lot of stuff that happens that he gives you no preparation for because he's unwilling to take the time.
This is the hard question that we have to ask of our most venerable artists. When is it over?
When is it over?
When, you know, I used to feel this way. I still feel this way. Controversies aside about Woody Allen.
Yes.
I felt like even his writing, when he writes his essays, they just aren't the same. They are just flaccid and there's like he's missing it. He's missing the beats. It just is off. And it feels like there's something deflated about it or hollow, you know? And I worry that as Clint Eastwood gets up there, we've mentioned it several times now, this legendary style, right, where he does one or two takes and he says cut, print. I feel like maybe in his younger days that wasn't quite as true.
Mm-hmm.
And now that's just I'm guessing. It wasn't quite as true, and therefore you had fewer sort of overt missteps, right, like Absolute Power, which just and Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. So I just wonder if he's become calcified in that regard, and if, you know, these movies here on out will always suffer from that because he's just not in tune.
Well, that's a great point. One I've thought about. When I see him with his curved spine, when I see he's now 6'2" now when he used to be 6'4".
Yeah.
When I see the signs of age.
Yeah.
You know, can barely squint because it's permanent on his face anyway. He doesn't have to work at it. I think this film is a metaphor for the aging, robust human being who will not give in to the inevitable. And he doesn't. And therefore, when I go to it, and I'm so conscious that he's 91, because I think I want to applaud him. I want to see how he works at it. I can see in the slower pace than he's ever had, when I can see what you were talking about, his reluctance to go into depth, but rather to have the one-liner take care of everything, I can see the manifestation of age, but I also find it salutary.
Hmm.
I like watching it. I like watching an old man doing his stuff,
mm-hmm.
not as well as he did, and maybe because I think of myself, and all of us can think of ourselves, aging. And I don't know anybody else who's in his 90s who does what he does and goes out and plays golf right after.
Right.
So anyway, yes.
But what happens, apart from the physical, what happens to the... What happens to the artist at that age? Why do so many great artists start to flag? You know, is it just because they're physically tired, or is it because somehow mentally they're resigned to what happens? Why do artists in their old age lose their ability to create truly great art?
There was recently a study, and people will laugh at our PhD candidates and others, a study of why old people are so sad.
Mm.
The answer is that they're going to die sooner than the rest of us. And and it is partly an answer to what you were saying. I believe that the concept of whatever's going to happen, that last chapter, weighs heavily on an artist, where an artist's art is not as important as how that artist is preparing for the inevitable.
Interesting.
And I don't think they can get away with it.
Yeah, and I think maybe too, what do you think of this, that there's an element of he knows his best work is behind him?
And that too. Yes.
And maybe he doesn't really care. And so it's just he has the privilege to keep making these movies, and so he will, and they will or will not work, and so what? Quality be damned. He knows that he made Unforgiven and Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, and Dirty Harry, and he's done.
Yeah, and a lot of that is a legacy that carries along for those of us who like him, who watch him. We're carrying all of his baggage along with us. We're enjoying the ride along with him. And Warner Brothers apparently doesn't care that it's not going to make any money because they can keep him in their stable. They can still have their logo at the beginning.
Right.
And he is iconic in our culture. So, you know, a whole bunch of reasons why they give him a chance that they don't give a great up-and-coming filmmaker that same opportunity. But I'll tell you what.
Well, look,
it's entertaining.
I mean,
it's entertaining.
Yeah. But the business relationship with Warner Brothers is long and storied, and he's made them probably $1 billion. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And like I said before, you know, when these movies of his that he's never had a special effect in his movie. The one movie, and I don't know if you'll even remember this movie, back in the early 80s was called Firefox, where he was a pilot stealing a plane from the Russians.
No.
There was a little special effects in that movie.
I wonder if there were any in the Iger sanction.
Not really.
Because I think I climbed up there. Remember that shot of me?
I mean, no special effects.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, there's maybe stunt people, but, no special effects in the way that, you know, the worlds that he creates on film are the worlds that you're seeing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's nothing, there's no green screen. That stuff doesn't exist in Clint Eastwood movies. And I just think that's really fascinating to think about. That here in 2021, at the age of 91, this guy can still tell stories about human beings.
Yep.
And tell
them
in a
way.
Right. And tell them in a way that doesn't feel like, you know, these little precious indie movies. he's still operating in a Hollywood kind of framework. You know? But they're still human.
And I'd like to, as I always do with you, I always like to offer up two of his favorite categories.
Okay.
Okay? And we always do this. His favorite films.
Okay. Wait.
I'm now going to give you a list of his favorite films.
Okay. I can't take a guess at any of them?
Let
me just guess that one of them's Frank Capra. Is anything directed by Frank Capra in there?
They don't have anything, but close. How Green Was My Valley. Mm. 39 Steps.
Okay.
Sergeant York. The Oxbow Incident.
Okay.
Chariots of Fire. How
what?
About that? Well, it's got
Chariots
that.
Of Fire.
It's got that.
What?
That's a macho, right?
No, I don't know. That movie, it's like him in his boring mode, like, you know.
Well, all right. His favorite actors.
Okay. Robert Mitchum.
Yes, is one.
Okay. Right. Jimmy Stewart.
Yes, is another.
Okay.
Good one. And here are the others. James Cagney.
All right.
No surprise. Gary Cooper.
All right.
Humphrey Bogart. And also, as another interesting point, he was offered Pacino's role in Any Given Sunday, and he turned down his buddies, Warner Brothers, because they wouldn't let him direct.
Oh, interesting.
So he got to a point with them where he's going to do that or not.
That would have been interesting to see him directed by Oliver Stone. I would have liked to see what fireworks come of that. Interesting. Yeah, so
what do we have?
I mean, what we have is, you know, I don't know. I just this image that he's created, this icon that he has created, this persona specifically on screen has meant so much to me. And I'm not sure why. I don't know if it's, I just think about me being a young boy and seeing him, that face on screen, mm-hmm. and just being mesmerized by mm-hmm. it and watching like mm-hmm. almost anything he was in by virtue of that face. Mm-hmm. So this is a body of work that I'll always revisit mm-hmm. for the rest of my mm-hmm. life. I feel like I'm relatively young, half this guy's age. And, you know, I just don't like to see him go. I wish that we lived in a world that would always have Clint Eastwood movies.
Well, I hope Cry Macho is not his last.